We're going to go ahead and start with the question and answer session, and I'll start with the questions posted online. Excuse me, if we get through those and still have time, we'll take questions over the phone, but it seems like there are quite a number posted in the chat area, so I'm going to start from the top down. First question is, some of these are for specific presenters. This one I'm going to put out to all three presenters and just let any one of you jump in. This presentation covered implications regarding the Gulf and Atlantic coasts, but what are the impacts to the Great Lakes?
Hey Bruce, you want to? It's Richard.
Yeah, I'll take a stab at that one. The Great Lakes have been doing a number of studies on attracting container vessels into that service. They're not necessarily Asian trades, but maybe more European trades. So in that regard, it's the bulks that go through the canal, obviously there might be bulk traffic that goes through the Great Lakes, but I do not see the canal as really being either a competitor or an assistance to the wholly separate market.
Rodolfo can probably address this in great detail. I would only say, my experience working at the canal and my knowledge of these trade routes, what I know about the Great Lakes, I agree with that. I don't see what's going on at the canal as being a major factor for the Great Lakes area. There are a lot of other things that we could talk about, but the canal expansion is not one of them, I think, that will have a major impact.
Rodolfo, any thoughts? Do we still have Rodolfo on the line?
Because we lost him. If he's not there, I noticed a couple of the questions that came up about the canal itself and the expansion project that were pretty straightforward that I can address if you'd like me to, as we come to them.
Sure. Rodolfo, I guess it sounds like maybe we lost you from the line. If you want to try calling back in, we can come back to your questions. Just let us know if you're back on. But I'll just keep going on here, and I'll put all the questions out there, and Richard and Bruce, if you want to answer them, go ahead. Let's see here. The next question is, and I'm sorry, I think my screen is jumping around here. What kind of impacts would a change in manufacturing sourcing locations, either within Asia or nearshoring back to North America, have on Panama Canal volumes and revenues?
Okay. That one, obviously, I can't. It's Richard Wainio. I can't answer that one for Rodolfo and the Panama Canal in terms of specific impact on their revenues from that. But there's Rodolfo. I see a line with something. I would just say, and if Rodolfo has a way of putting in more detail on this, obviously the sourcing, the East Coast of the United States is one of the things. We've been talking about East-West trade through Panama or intermodally. We should not lose sight of the fact that a good deal of trade into the eastern part of the United States obviously comes through Suez. As markets, production facilities shift down into Southeast Asia, increasingly to India over time, I think there will be a larger share of U.S. imports moving through Suez and direct into U.S. East Coast ports. That obviously would work against the Panama Canal in a sense. It doesn't mean that they're not going to maintain or have the same, have very large volumes through Panama, but clearly if you shift from China, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, if they lose market share to India and Southeast Asia, you're going to have some impact on the canal. You also have, from our perspective, we mentioned Cuba. I see Cuba potentially, and not immediately, obviously, but in the years ahead, becoming perhaps a major maquiladora a location, a la Mexico and the DR and some of the others. I see a lot of companies from around the world to position themselves to be 90 miles off the U.S. and U.S. companies, in fact, unfortunately, perhaps moving offshore to Cuba as well. think that'll become a player to some extent. I think the biggest shift, in a nutshell, is from China and North Asia down into South Asia and India, which would then run that volume through Suez and into the East Coast instead of all water through Panama.
Thank you. I'm not sure if one second, if the operator, Joyce, if you're on, for some reason it sounds like Rodolfo is hearing us, but we can't hear him when he speaks.
This line's open.
Rodolfo, are you there?
This line is open. Did you mute your line?
Can you hear me?
Now we can.
Okay. Yeah, well, I can follow up on what Richard was saying. Yes, we do see some movement or some changes in the manufacturing and going south of what we call our hinterland. I mean, we think that the Panama Canal's hinterland, as far as Asia is concerned, is north of Hong Kong. And anything south of that, when you have, you know, manufacturing moving to Thailand or to Vietnam or to Indonesia or to even India, of course, that is something that will most likely move through the Suez Canal. And in the case of Cuba, yes, we have also been following what is happening in Cuba. We see an important development in case the embargo is lifted, and the many possibilities that brings to Cuba, both to become a major transshipment hub as well as to become an interesting place to manufacture. One thing that and there was another question addressing this same issue that I'd like to respond now. One of the things that we like to see in the future, and we're working all for this, is to make sure that Panama adds value in everything that is coming through here. Instead of just looking or watching vessels go through, first of all, the development of Panama as a transshipment hub adds value to the shipping lines in terms of being able to not only transit, but also fill the vessel with cargo going in the return trip. What we have seen in the Pacific side, for instance, is the development of most of the loops all the way from Mexico to Chile coming to transship in the Pacific side, so that the imbalance in trade that will continue in between the United States and Asia can, by the for the shipping line, become added value to use the canal, because that way they can bring or additional cargo with, of course, additional freight rate in the return leg, and that is one of the areas that we want to expand. We also want to position Panama not only as a place for transshipment, but also a place where you can add value to the cargo itself. And one of the initiatives that we've been working on is to actually sell Panama as a place where you can actually be closer to the final market and do more things to the cargo rather than just transshipping as it has been in the past.
We had someone just type in if you could clarify what transshipment is.
Oh, okay. I mean, transshipment in the general sense is moving from one mother vessel to a feeder vessel, cargo that is destined to a port that may be maybe not have enough density of cargo requirement to be able to call for the mother vessel to go there. So it's sort of like what you have with the airlines. I mean, a transshipment hub in an airline, it would be like Miami, where a lot of the larger airplanes are bringing passengers there to hub to another to other smaller services that may be then shifted to smaller airplanes.
Okay. Bruce, did you want to... I just wanted to give you a chance, too, if you want to jump in.
Two things is that, one, there's the pending free trade agreement with Panama that, obviously, if we ever signed it, because of Panama as a country has done very well in banking and telecommunications with the fiber optics, it really is a they recognize, as Rodolfo said, this idea of adding value is going to be critical, because there's a lot of competition in Latin America right now to kind of develop these maquiladoras and to develop logistics centers and supply chains, and really tying that into the global economy, where you can creating value and things of that nature. And nobody mentioned, of course, the one of the largest trade lanes is west coast of South America coming up to the U.S. With the bananas and some bananas of the Chilean stone fruits and grapes. So there's a lot of cargo that's going to move regardless of where markets shift, just because the ongoing institutional relationships and supply chains and the agreement. So even though there's discretionary cargo, there's a certain inertia that will keep a lot of cargo going into the same trade patterns.
I would also put in the pitch for the Colombia Free Trade Agreement also. I think it's very important that the United States move forward with these kinds of agreements. I think most of us that are on this telephone call, at least, certainly I believe, support generally free trade. I'm not trying to take a political position on this, but global trade is increasingly important to this country, and we need to move forward with these agreements.
Well, I think we personally get away from Latin America simply being either a source of drugs or a destination for a cruise, and really view it as an economic neighbor that has a lot of potential if we can develop trade with them.
Absolutely.
And stabilize democracies.
I'd like to have something regarding the trade lanes. I agree with most of what has been said, in the sense that there may not be a total growth significant enough to make all the ports go for the deeper and channels. But what one has to keep in mind is that when these larger vessels start moving in this all water route, most likely they will not want to call too many ports. So there will be some winners and there will be some losers. It is not going to be the same. You know, the larger vessels will want to call ports where there is enough concentration and density of cargo to fill or unload most of the vessels. And this is really why we see also Panama in with regard to the rest of the transshipment places in the area. I mean, you have to stop by Panama to transit. In most cases, this is what most of these Panamaxes are doing now. Some of them are calling Panamanian ports first before transiting, and then after transiting, because there is enough added cargo for the vessel to make it advantageous and profitable. So you really need to keep this in mind. When you have the larger vessel, you will want to minimize the stops of that vessel. And you want to minimize them, and therefore there will be some ports that, if they're definitely out of that picture, they will have to be receiving feeder vessels from wherever transshipment hub there may be in the Caribbean, or unless there is a change in the Jones Act, you will see then something else. But as it is right now, you will have direct calls for cargo that is going to go to specific ports where they can use most of their capacity, and they are ready to unload, having or given, of course, the connectivity to maybe secondary places of consumers.
Okay, thank you. I think we're having a good discussion here. I don't think we're going to get through all the questions, so I'm just going to kind of skip around here and just pick some of the questions out. And if we don't get through them all, what I'll do is I'm going to send them to the presenters, and then when I send the follow-up information, I will email some responses that the presenters have provided for the questions. In what year will the Panama Canal expansion project be completed and open to larger cargo ships?
Our plan is to have it in the year 2014, and we hope to have it the close to the same date when we commemorate the 100th anniversary of the canal.
Thank you. I'll put a question out for Bruce. What lifespan do you estimate on the new lock dimensions, given the trend on making vessels bigger and bigger?
Well, the idea is, you know, potentially, you know, it talks about having a second screw, that nature. But if you look at the bulk industry, we went to the UL, the very large crude containers and the ULCCs, and really those are so big that there's only specialized ports that can handle them. As Rodolfo said, you know, the 12,000, 13,000 TEU vessels are really going to just be in those mainline, long-distance, high-density lanes, and they're not going to be running all over the place. And I really think that because of the extent of tonnage that's going to be on order and being deployed over the next few years, that, as I do with Richard, that the 6,000 to 8,000 TEU vessels is going to kind of be the new workhorse of the supply chain industry.
I would add, Richard, I'm sorry, Bruce, I didn't mean to cut you off.
And I was going to say, in the 1300s are going to be, you know, the high-density Trans-Pacific, Far East to Europe, pretty much in those lanes.
I would just add that, you know, what drives ships and ship size is essentially the type of cargo and the volume of cargo, and to some degree, the length of the trade route. For whoever asked that question, keep in mind that right now there's basically only three or four types of cargoes in the world out of the hundreds or thousands of different cargo types that move. There's only three or four types that actually move in ships that are, you know, larger than Panamax, basically. Talking coal and iron ore, crude petroleum for the most part, you do have, you know, but in any case, with the expansion of the locks, you know, if you're talking chemical carriers and product carriers and a lot of these things, you're talking ships that even now don't really exceed 150,000 deadweight ton kind of range. I mean, the very largest ships were built back in the 70s, and they haven't built them that big since. When you talk about tankers, bulk carriers, they haven't been building bigger and bigger and bigger ships, except container ships, and there's got to be not only in terms of engineering, you know, technology, but also in terms of volumes of ports and systems and roads and everything else. There's a limit to how many containers you can bring in on one ship. Already, if you're talking about bringing in, as we've been discussing, a ship of 15,000 TEUs, you know, there's very few ports in the world that can really handle those kind of ships efficiently. So the bottom line here is it took 100 years almost before the canal, before they started to build so many container ships that Rodolfo really needed to put in this expanded lock capability. I don't even think it'd be safe to say 100 years before you'd have to modify it again. I don't think you'll ever have to expand it again. If anything, you'll have to build some new and different type of transportation system 50 or 100 years down the road. Put on your science fiction cap and think of a world that doesn't even have ships. But as long as they have ships, I think the canal with the expansion lane they're putting in is going to be pretty much enough to handle the vast majority of vessels that are going to be plying the world's routes.
Richard, I want to add something. There was an editorial that I saw, a historic editorial that came out in like 1905, talking about why are we building the canal when we have dirigibles and Zeppelins who can carry cargo around the world.
Yeah.
So, obviously,
something about
there.
The size of vessels. When we were doing our marketing studies to determine the size of the new lock, we were meeting constantly with the different shipping lines and their planning and strategies of people. And even though we received feedback from some of them that they would like it, you know, the locks to be larger, to be able to accommodate the 15, even they were talking about 18,000 TEUs. We really had a very, very close look at the cost and benefit of this, and we arrived to a mid-size from what they were asking, and something that, by the way, we still think, and we agree with the other two speakers, that the workhorse in this route is not likely to be the 12,000 or maybe not even the 10,000 TEU vessel, but more likely the 6 and 8,000 TEU vessel, and that will take some time, you know, for those vessels to be fully deployed in this route. I mean, we think that the vessel that is put in service depends mainly on the density of cargoes and the amount of cargo concentration that you can have in the specific ports that you want to call. And I know that a few years ago there was a Dr. Asaf Ashar who came up with the theory that once the canal expanded, then the old trade lanes of post-Panamax would converge into what he called the equatorial route, which was like a around-the-world route that would be moving in east direction one and in west direction the other. I mean, there are many things that are still out there that have been written, you know, that need to be analyzed. But we really think that the size of the locks that we came up with is a size that will be able to serve a world trade for maybe not as much as 100 years, but maybe long enough for us to plan and decide if we need to expand further the canal. I mean, we don't think that the expansion of the canal, again, is limited to this expansion that we're doing right now. If there was demand and if there was really a financial justification to expand further, then we would look at that and we would study it like we did this one, and we would determine when we need it and if it is merit to do it.
Okay. Well, thank you. We're actually out of time now. I know we have a number of questions we didn't get to, and I will send those to the presenters and hopefully get some responses out to all attendees via email. This was a really good seminar, a lot of good information. I appreciate everyone's interest in it, and I appreciate all three presenters for your taking the time for these three great presentations. I know you're all busy, and I think this was very informative. So we'll go ahead and close out. The recording and the presentations will all be available online within the next 2 weeks, and I'll send out an email when they become available. As a reminder, if you are an AICP member and would like to receive 1.5 certification maintenance credits for attending today's seminar, please make sure you were signed in today with your first and last name, or if you were not, or if you attended with a group, make sure that your first and last name has been typed into the chat box. Please also download the evaluation form and email it to me after you've completed it. And even if you're not an AICP member and want to send me the evaluation form and provide any feedback, we definitely welcome it. And please also download the certification maintenance credit instructions if you're unsure of how to obtain your credits for today's seminar. The next seminar will be held on November 16th and will be about security and system resiliency. That seminar, as well as the December seminar, are both open for registration. We're also still collecting any topic ideas for the 2010 seminar series, so feel free to email me any ideas you have for topics or presenters. If you haven't done so already, I encourage you to visit the Talking Freight website and sign up for the November and or December seminars. And I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv. So with that, we'll close out. Thank you, everybody. Thank you again, all three presenters, and enjoy the rest of your day.